I like to start just with a teensy-weensy bit of a background because it makes no sense to people that I would that I had the near-death experience I had without giving you an idea of what got me there in the first place. I had a really idyllic childhood and until about 7 years old, at which time my mom started taking psychology classes at UNLV and kind of grew up and left home. She joined what would be considered a cult, basically. And a lot of what happened there was just really traumatic, really awful. There was a boy, they were starving. He was my age. He was just allowed bread and water in his underwear, bread and water once a day. And this was deep into Bryce Canyon. Everybody was in teepees. There was no power. And he was made to be across the river from everybody else because he had a speech impediment. And they were, they called this deprivation therapy because he had a speech impediment. And I noticed we have some children in the room, so I'm actually not going to elaborate at all. So it was just my sister and I. My sister's younger than me by a year and a half, and we were left with my father. That was pretty horrific as well. I don't think we brushed our teeth for a year. There were no rules. We were abused. So all these things happened, and I didn't realize I was impacted by it until many years later when I got married. I got married at 19 and thought, oh, this is going to be great and wonderful, and it was really abusive as well. So I just kind of stuffed all of this and buried it all. And there came a point, I think it was about 22, 23, 24, right in there, I started having this cyclical depression. It was every 6 months, every January and June, I would just dive into 3 weeks of complete anxiety. I couldn't leave the house. I did things that were completely contrary to my character, and I couldn't figure out a way out of this. I couldn't sort it out. Counselors had no idea what this was and couldn't help me. So I was right in the middle of one of these bouts. It was January 6th, 1991. I was right in the middle of one of these. We lived in Okinawa, Japan at the time, and I had two little boys. I had a four-year-old and a one-year-old. Ricky and Charlie. And if you have the book, or if you get the book, Beyond the Darkness, it's Alex and Jacob in the book. They're all grown and turned out wonderful. And so they're okay me using their names now. I just didn't want to use them at the time without their permission, given they were, you know, just kids and wanted them to be able to go to soccer without a problem. So I got in the car. It was about 10 o'clock at night in my slippers and in my sweats for the purpose of going to the convenience store to get milk. I went and I got milk, and I came back, parked in the driveway in front of my house, and could not go in. I sat out there for the longest time, and I just could not make myself go in the house. I went to the beach all night. Then I went to the movies, and I saw the film Flatliners the next day. It's a group of people who are experimenting with actually dying and then bringing themselves back with paddles and having these near-death experiences. That's what I did the day before. And went to the BX, which is kind of the equivalent of Walmart for the military, and I washed my hair in the sink in the bathroom, bought some shampoo, and finally ran out of things to do and decided, okay, I guess I better go face the music. And I went home, and I walk in the front door, and there's my husband and my two children, and it's probably 10 o'clock at night. It's probably been about a full 24 hours that I've been gone. And there they are, kneeling on the floor, praying, of course, for my safe return. And my husband gets up, and he's white as a sheet, and he just comes up to me, throws his arms around me, and says, I'm so glad you're okay. The next morning, my five-year-old wouldn't speak to me. He just kind of curled himself up in a ball in the corner in the kitchen and just would not talk to me. He was so angry. And my one-year-old wouldn't let me put him down. So I spent the day trying to sort out how in the world I'm going to continue to live this life. And I couldn't continue to do that to my children. And I really believed in that moment that I was doing the right thing, that I was doing the thing that was going to end a lot of years of suffering and pain for them. So when everybody went to bed, I happened to listen to a lot of the Smiths and a lot of that kind of dark music at the time. And there was one song that I was playing over and over all night long on repeat. And I don't remember the name of it, but the words go, oh mother, I can feel the soil falling over my head. The sea wants to take me. The knife wants to cut me. Do you think you can help me? I wrote a note to my sister and my husband and my children and just apologized and gave them my earrings. I had these pearl earrings and my wedding rings, left them to them. And I went and swallowed a bottle of pills. And most of that came up. I considered washing it off and swallowing it again, and I didn't. Instead, what I did is I broke apart a safety razor and got into the bathtub in a white dress and slit my wrists and discovered that that's not such an easy thing to do. So I got out of the tub, I wrapped them up, and I'm looking in the bathroom mirror at myself. And I had studied psychology, so I knew something about, you know, different disorders, and I could see somebody else in my eyes. I could see somebody else in this body with me. And I thought I had multiple personality disorder in that moment. So then I went back downstairs. I started taking everything in the medicine cabinet and just in slow increments so that I could hold it down. And it took most of the night to do this, to be able to retain it and take enough, just keep this balance going. My husband got up for work, and about that time, I went up and got back in bed. And this was probably about, the sun wasn't up, so it was probably about 4 or 5 in the morning. He was an air weapons control officer at Kadena Air Force Base in Okinawa. So it's NORAD, and it's a lockdown. You know, they go for their shift, and then they leave. There's no coming home for lunch kind of thing. And so he asks me, are you okay? And I said, I'm fine. And that was it. And he left for work. And then I went back downstairs, and I continued to do this through the morning until my children woke up. And I sent a note with them to my neighbor. I had a close neighbor. We shared babysitting all the time. And I wrote a note, said, I don't feel well. Will you keep the boys? And sent them out the door. And it was probably about an hour later, I started to feel it happening. I'm laying down on the couch. By this time, I can't walk anymore. I'm laying down on the couch, and I start to have the experience like there's an F-15 landing in my backyard. There's this incredible energy, this vibration that's so powerful. It just feels like this long, drawn-out tremor. Like, I remember thinking that it feels like being in the belly of a 747 during takeoff, like I'm laying down on the in the aisleway. And at the same time, I'm hearing this incredible whirring noise, and it's deafening. So I look out the window behind me to see, really, is there a plane coming down? And that's when I realize, I can see the sun, you know, pouring in, and I realize this is happening here. I'm like, oh, wow, here we go. And so I had a stepmother who'd had a near-death experience, and she'd gone up to the corner of the room and had watched. She'd been in a car accident, and she watched everybody working on her, and then she interacted with people that had died that were her family, and she was told, you have more to do. You can choose, come back or not come back, but life's going to be hard if you come back, but you can choose. So this is what I expected. And this is back in 91. This was before Betty Eady's book came out, so there was Life Everlasting that I owned, but I hadn't actually read. So there was not that much out there about near-death experience at the time. So I open my eyes because I want to watch. And when I open my eyes, I can feel myself surge back in my body. And so I'm slightly confused about what's going on. So I close my eyes again, and when I close my eyes, what I can see in front of me is this yellow, like this rich gold yellow membrane, and it's illuminated, and it's filled with these red lines just running through it like a road map. And I can feel this happening again. I can feel my body and my spirit separating. So I open my eyes so I can watch, and the minute I do that, I surge back into my body. And I do this a couple times before I just give myself over to the experience. I realized it required more than just what I had done, but also my will. I submitted to the experience, and as soon as I did, I was surrounded by this yellow membrane, and it became multidimensional, and I was being squeezed, and my arms were like this, and I was being squeezed. And at the same time, I'm having the experience of a contraction, like I'm having a baby all at once. And I'm pushed through this membrane. I have this sensation of complete euphoria, like nothing but love, nothing but peace, nothing but I want this life. And it wasn't until later I realized that was my birth. I went directly into my life review. That was the first thing that happened for me. And so as soon as I'm squeezed out of this membrane, I'm being cradled like this by a woman. And I'm confused about what's happening because I'm having the experience of everybody. I'm the baby, I'm the mother, I'm this third party observer, like the dead person who would do this kind of thing to her family. I'm everything at once. And so I'm looking up at this woman and she looks just like me. And she's talking. She turns her head and she's talking to somebody else in the room. I can't understand a word she's saying. I just know that she wanted me and that she loved me. And there's a lot that happened over the years as a kid, especially when she left, that I really believed she didn't. Then I went through every single moment of my life, like every single moment of my life. But it wasn't like we measure time here. There were some things that were long and drawn out, and I had the full experience, everybody. Like my little legs, 4 years old, 5 years old at a birthday party, my little legs dangling off the chair and I can feel the dress. But it's like I get all of it, like the experience of the dress as well. Not just my experience as a four-year-old, but all of it. And then there were other things I skipped through very quickly. And I came all the way to the end where I was lying on the couch. And at some point during this, I realized I was also viewing it on a screen that was before me. That was part of it as well. And all these things are happening all at the same time. It's all completely simultaneous. And then I come all the way abruptly to the end where I'm lying on the couch and it ceases. And there's a presence next to me on my left. He's male and I know that I know him intimately and I can't see anybody there. And he says, "This is your life. This is the life you lived. That's it." There was no drama or significance about it. It was just really simple. This is it. And that's when I knew I was dead. And so I looked around for members of my family that had passed on. I'd had an uncle that was in a car accident when I was 11. My grandmother had passed on when I was 14. And then I also had a cousin who died when she was 11, when I was about maybe six, I think. So I'm looking for them, and there's nobody there. There's just this complete darkness. But it's not just an absence of light. There is this palpable energy, and it's hovering around my lower extremities. I'm surrounded by darkness, but it's almost like a mist. But it's comprised of molecules of darkness, and it has an energy. It has voice. Have you ever seen the film Finding Nemo? There's a scene where the school of fish are all giving directions, and they're all talking at the same time. It was like that. Like all this energy was completely stitched together and in unison and causing the same kind of creations. And it began sucking the life from me. And so I'm looking around for my deceased loved ones and I think, well, Uncle Sid maybe not here, but Lisa, you know, she was really an angel. And it doesn't occur to me that maybe I'm not where they are. And so I swing my head to the right while I'm looking for him. And to my right, there is a line of teenagers. And there's about six of them. And I lean over and look at them. And there's a girl on the far end, and she's about 16 years old, and she has this dishwater blonde hair, and it's just stringy, just really a waif. And I look at her, and she's just as empty as, it's really beyond words that we have in human language to describe. She is empty beyond dead. And I think to myself, what in the world could have been so bad about her life that she'd take her life? And I knew she had done that. And there's a kid standing next to me. He's a boy. He's probably about 16 as well. And he's tall, and he has dyed black spiky hair, black eyeliner, a black leather vest, white t-shirt, combat boots. And I'm thinking, we must be the suicides. And then he turns his head, looks down at me, and that's when I realized my thoughts were audible. Could be heard. And as soon as I had that thought, I was taken. And I traveled at what I think is probably the speed of light through this darkness. And I have no idea how far I went. I don't know if it was the length of a football field or the other side of the planet. And I think it was probably closer to somewhere on the other side of the planet. And I ask a question while I'm in transit. What is this? and I can see my landing place as I approach. And I hear the word purgatory come into my mind, which is very interesting because I do not have a Catholic background. So I didn't exactly know what that meant. I descend upon this plane, and it's this beltway. It's probably as deep as from me to the end of the room, and it stretches as far as I can see to the left. And I know there are thousands and thousands of people there. I land I slow down just as I land. I look around, and everybody is adult, and they're all in white robes, and their robes are all filthy, which is something I thought was figurative. And something about the kid is I thought, well, that's interesting. I wouldn't think that eyeliner and hair dye is something you take with you. So I look around, and everybody is kind of like talking to themselves is what it appears. But the first thing I notice is how completely disconnected they are from each other. Like absolutely zero interaction with each other at all. None. And here they are surrounded by all these people. And they're saying things like, if only you had blah, blah, blah. It's not dawning on me that I'm just like this. It didn't occur to me. And there was one woman in particular who was just really loud and just wailing and carrying on, big beehive hairdo. And then there was a man that I remember in particular who was squatting. And he was watching me. He noticed me and he was just observing. And I knew he'd been there for a long time. I knew he'd been there for a couple thousand years. I knew he'd killed himself. I knew his eyes were blue, and I was seeing in grayscale. And I thought, I wonder if this is Judas Iscariot, which brought the next piece of the experience. Also there, behind me, there was a school chair, like a wood and steel little kid's chair, and it was kind of flickering in and out of existence, and I knew it was not there for me. And then there was a vanity as well. And I could see through it. I could see the drawers were empty, and I knew that that was there for me. And if I don't remember to come back and tell you, somebody please ask the question, what was the vanity about? Okay, sometimes I forget. So the moment I think, I wonder if this is Judas Iscariot, it is an acknowledgement that I believe in a Christ. The moment I have that thought, there is a pinpoint of light. All this happened at the same time. There's a pinpoint of light that appears in the distance, and I hear a voice. And it is like thunder, but not loud, but it reverberates. I can hear that it has the power to span the entire planet. He says, is this what you really want? And all of this energy around me starts reverberating. This is God, this is God, this is God, this is God, this is God. And he travels to me at the speed of light, and he stops some distance from me, because he can't come in where I am, and I know that he can't. And he is made of light. He's filled with light. And I've never seen anything more completely beautiful in my life. And he defies description. He had white hair that was flowing with a rounded widow's peak and white robes. He was perfect in every way. And he said, is this what you really want? And it hadn't occurred to me that I wanted this. And I said, but my life is so hard. And he said, you think it's hard now? And then he says, you can't skip over parts. We've all done this. This is the worst thing you could have done. You've been a tool for darkness. I told you how to do this. And in that moment, I remember having a conversation with a minister of mine years prior. And just asking the question, how can I get through this? And he says, if I tell you, then you have to do it. And I said, okay. And then, of course, I didn't do it. And he says, if you will pray, and if you will bury yourself in the scriptures, God will take care of the rest. And I had some weeks of success with that. And I still can't see how I could do my life. And I'm also kind of like, wow, this is like kind of blown away that God like has time for little old me. And then I hear another voice. And at the same time, I see pinpricks of light coming through the darkness. And I realize that there's another being there that I can't see. There's some kind of a barrier that I can't see. And I hear his voice say, don't you understand I did this for you? And it's the same presence that was there with me during my life review that said, this is your life. This is the life you lived. All at once, I'm experiencing multiple points of view. I'm still standing where I'm standing, looking at them, having this conversation, bewildered. And at the same time, I'm behind them watching this almost like a download of information. And I knew this is my Savior. I knew this was Christ. And he's passing all of this information, like my life, over to my Father. And I knew that was my Father. And he just passes all this information to him. And it's at the speed of light. It's perfect and complete. And at the same time, I am taken into Christ's body in the Garden of Gethsemane while he's experiencing my life. And that's when I got, somebody else really does get what I'd been through. You know, the really astounding thing was that he didn't just do that for me like he did it for everybody. I still didn't think I could do this. I still didn't think I could come back and make this work. I've been praying for years to sort this out. And so then I was shown what would happen with my children. And I just had the two boys at the time. I have eight now, five grandchildren. So I was shown my oldest boy's life first. And I got this roller coaster of just the whole energy of his life, all of it. And he got all the way to be about 20 years old. And he looked just like that kid that was standing next to me at the beginning of my near-death experience. And I knew he was rendered completely incapable of doing a single thing he came here to do because I took my life. And then I was shown what would happen to my younger boy, and he was a year old at the time, and he got all the way up to 7 years old, and then he was taken because he couldn't do this without me. And in that moment, I said the little tiniest smidge of an okay. And then I was lifted up, and all of a sudden, I'm seeing all of this below me. And I can just see all these people falling down on my right, standing there, filling up the space off to my right. And I can see this energy, just like this crackling energy, just sucking the life right out. And I'm surrounded. I'm at a little higher plane, and I'm surrounded by these beings of light that are just flying around me so fast I can hardly make them out. They're made of light. They're angels. I ask, what is this? And I'm told, they're helping you. And they always have been. Most people who are dying now are going to a place of darkness. And something I want to say here, too, is that I'm clear this is a way station and that nobody stays there. It's not like that. It's like you just go and you get complete about what you left behind, and then you're out of there, just like I was. I just happen to have a body to come back to. And when I was pregnant with my second boy, twice I had a loaded shotgun in my mouth with my toe on the trigger cocked, and I couldn't do it because I was expecting. Now, had I done something like that, I wouldn't have had a body to come back to. And I'm also certain that these people were not just talking to themselves. They were also interacting with other people I couldn't see. The man that was squatting when I was interacting with God and with Christ, he was watching this happen, and he couldn't see them. But he was watching me have this exchange. So it would have looked to him like I was talking to nobody. So I just want to make sure anybody who's lost anybody this way, just pray for them, really. It's never, never the end, okay? And so then I travel through this darkness faster than I got there. And I'm just given all this information, all these things, all these questions I had about why does my marriage look the way it does? And that's when I really got to see how being a victim is a dance. It's like there's no such thing as a perpetrator without a victim. And then I was participating. You know, I was playing this game with him as well. That it's the small things that we do that make the biggest difference. So I know different near-death experiencers see the ripple effect differently. And the way it was shown to me was like a dandelion. Like you can blow a dandelion, and it has the power in 1 week's time to destroy your yard. And then in another week, it's the entire street. And like one dandelion has the power to populate the whole globe. And that is the way our actions are. That's the way our words in particular are. That we have immense power. We misuse it. We're ignorant or whatever. But we have no idea the power of the words we speak. None. And then there was a lot of other things I was told that I wasn't allowed to take with me. There were things I was told that were meant for me. Oh, something else I didn't say is I read a near-death experience once of a little boy, and he said that God looks like an old man without wrinkles, and that would be accurate. That's how I'd describe him too. So I go straight back into my body, and I lay down into my body, and I open my eyes, and I swing my legs down and I sit up on the couch. I can hardly do this. At the same time, the front door is swinging open and my husband's walking in through the door, which I told you earlier doesn't happen, and you know, at 11 o'clock in the morning or 11:30 in the morning. And he comes in and he sits down on the love seat next to me. And I say, "You're never going to believe this." And he says, "I think I just might." And then I look around the room and I have a lot of house plants, and they are made of light. I can still see this way, like light and darkness. And like trees are so incredibly just gift. And I can see all the service and what they do. And I look at my couch that I'm sitting on, and I can see the molecular structure of the couch. I can see it on an energetic level, and I can see the molecules vibrating. We are couch serving you, serving God. We are couch serving you, serving God. We are pillow serving you, serving God. We are table serving you, serving God. Like, choice is present. It's not like somebody pulled out their carpenter tools and said, "Here's a chair." It's like all of these pieces also agreed. That gift didn't leave me. I still see this way. It's not as pronounced as it was. It does come and go sometimes where it's like, whoa, the trees are white. But so I can still see this way. People are comprised of three elements. It's a body and then a spirit. And then there's also the energy. And the energy is one. We are connected one. It's not like kind of connected or it's like we're connected. It's we're one. And I could see how a smile has the power to alter things on the other side of the planet that you'll never know about. Oh, and the vanity. And I knew that the vanity was just a representation of my unwillingness to just humble myself and ask for what I needed. Pretty simple. So I left that behind too. And I'll tell you about my boys. It must have been about 2007. We took a trip down to Vegas. I lived in Idaho. We took a trip down to Las Vegas, where we used to live, to go see my oldest daughter there. My stepdaughter, I remarried. I was divorced, remarried, and then took on three more kids. She was grown, married, had her own kids. And my son was about 20 years old, and he had a new little girlfriend. And we all went down and came back, and we got home at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm going through my mail. And at some point during the trip, my debit card stopped working. And I thought, oh, well, I'll sort it out when I get home. No big deal. And I'm going through and I open my bank statement, and I'd had $10,000 in the bank. And my son and his little girlfriend took out $1,000 every day, except for the days they took out $2,000 and just blew it on stuff. And so there's my son, okay, standing there in the living room. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like, "Ricky, what did you do?" And it's that moment. When I was dead, there he was. It was that moment. And I heard a voice say, "Give him your coat also." And I said, "I'm not going to talk to you about this right now. I'll talk to you tomorrow." And then he disappeared with his girlfriend for a few months. But then I sold some tires he had in the garage. I said, "Come get your tire money." And he says, "Are you sure?" And I'm like, "Of course." And so he came, and everything got just patched up real quick and easy. He ended up marrying this little girl, and I've got these three amazing, amazing grandbabies. And this girl and I, we now have matching teal bathing suits with white polka dots, because we have our birthing hips now together. So, and then Charlie, I really stressed there for a couple of years, you know, as he approached that age. And he's still with me. He's 24. He's going to Slick, and he's at home, and he's a wild card for sure. But something I knew is he and I had an agreement before. He knew what he was getting into when he took on being my child during that time. And there is a sacred, sacred partnership between that boy and I. And I don't think he's ever moving out of my basement, unfortunately. But we were talking just the other day, actually spoke on Monday, and we were talking before I left, and he says, "You know, that whole year when I was 7, I just kept having the thought, well, if I die now, everything's good." And that he kind of had the idea that he was going to die too, but then didn't. So we're all happy. Okay, so there we go. That's it. So I'd love to answer any questions anybody has.
When you came to and you said to your husband, you'll never believe what happened, and he said, I just might. What was that?
What was what?
Why did he say, I just might
believe? He knew exactly what was going on. He's very intuitive anyway. We're divorced, but we're like really partners in that we brought these kids in together, and he's an amazing human being. He'd always been really intuitive, but he came home. He knew something was up. No reason at all, told his boss, I have to go home right now.
You said that the man that you thought was Judas Iscariot had been there 2,000 years. Do some people choose to stay in purgatory?
So to be clear, that was my own thought.
Right.
It had nothing to do with him. It was just like what I was perceiving was, wow, his eyes are blue. Gee, he's been here a long time. And I really have no accurate way of knowing what is really so for anybody else. And I have no idea. I will tell you this. Time is not measured outside of this planet like it's measured here. Time is a physical thing. It's the rotation of the planets. And we go about this chronologically day by day. And every day we're a day older, right? And so we measure everything this way. And there's a design to that and a purpose to that. But what has God be omniscient is that he's not stuck in time. It's like your life is a book. You are writing it. You're in charge. You're on page 64 and there's 132 pages. God can go see what you did at page 132 like that. So I have no idea because time is not measured the same way. 2,000 years may as well be 5 seconds, may as well be 5,000 years. It was like that. It was just like the experience of suffering was just so extraordinary. I just don't even have words for it, frankly.
Did you ever seek any professional help?
Ah, yes, I did.
Like spiritual help, too?
So the next day, I went and saw the chaplain on base, and he was extraordinary. And a lot of what I dealt with was very, very traumatic abuse. We worked a deal because I couldn't even talk about it. I would write in a journal, and I'd give it to him. He'd copy the pages, and then he'd read it, and he would have had read it when I came back, and then he could discuss it with me without me having to say any of it. And it was about a year later, I came in his office sobbing about something, just sobbing, and he just stops me, and he goes, do you know that you're crying? And this is like the first time that I'd cried in a whole year in dealing with all this. After Okinawa, we went to Washington State, and we lived on a lake, 2 Mile Lake, and I'd walk this lake every day, and I felt this coming on. And so I was praying, how am I going to get through this? And I'd left Okinawa. It was amazing. It was this completely healing place. And so here I was back in the States and dealing with this thing. And it was a January event. So I'm praying, and I hear a voice say, the truth will set you free. God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And in that moment, I really got what drove that for me was I could jettison responsibility for anything. I could blame that I do this cyclical thing. Kind of have this little trump card. Oh, Angie was doing the cyclical thing. And the minute I got that I was responsible for that, it disappeared and I never dealt with it again. Ever.
I'm so glad you got that help. I'm a chaplain too.
Thanks.
I'm a hospice chaplain.
Oh, good. Well, you're doing good work, so you know.
I would like you to elaborate on our loved ones that have passed that way. You said not to give up.
Yeah, no. I would not get caught up in, and I know this is a hard thing to hear and a hard thing to actually put into practice. And I have cards all over the place. Take a card, please, and call me. By the way, I'm totally accessible. You can call me, okay? It's never the end point. That's always just so that you can sort out what it is you need to sort out in order to progress.
So all of those souls that were there were sorting?
Sorting it out. Here's the thing about it is it's a really selfish act. It's actually very, very selfish. And you don't get that when you're in the middle of it. I mean, just like I said with this woman, I would have fully told you that I was a victim. I was spanked with a fly swatter when I was an infant in my crib. That's how my life began, right? I would have said, this is something that happened to me. I got this life. It happened to me. And that is not the case. I'll tell you something else, too, is I refuse to judge another human being. Ever. You just never know what people have agreed to. Ever. Does that answer your question? Okay, good.
You said that you had a body to come back to. Mm-hmm. I have a grandson who put a rifle in his mouth and pulled the trigger with his toe, blew off his head. I don't believe that he really wanted to do that, that he, it was just, you know, some words that were spoken, and it was just like it was the last straw, and I don't think he really meant to do it. Where is he, and what hope does he have?
I couldn't tell you, but I will tell you this, that he's in good hands, that absolutely there's nothing that you do that God is not with you and present for, and completely loves you, like beyond what you can even fathom love could look like. And we're the ones that are bent on imposing punishment. It's not that kind of thing. It's just like, get how this was for other people. That's really it. And the minute you do.
The other thing you said, words are very powerful. That, yeah. And I really believe that. My I have a daughter that she says something, and oh my gosh, she's so pure. She is so perfect. Things happen almost instantly mm-hmm. when she thinks it. It's unreal. So I know the power, and I've really been working hard on that. And it does change your life when you work on thinking positive all the time.
Well, something I take on is God be able to say, let there be light, and there's light, is that he has perfect relationship to his word. He never, ever dishonors his word. He will not, cannot do that, or he ceases to be God. So a practice I take on is actually honoring my word. And I have that kind of power too, where like I'll just say it and there it is. It just shows up. And then you know, as a human being, you're not going to always do that. We don't. So your access then is to restore power to your word. So when there is something to clean up, go clean it up. Don't hang out with like something. You know, when my father passed, there was nothing more to say. I didn't even have to say I forgive you because it had been said. There was just nothing but love. So get it all taken care of, clean it up, and get it over with.
Based upon your experience, Heavenly Father loves all of us unconditionally. Mm-hmm. Why is there so much evil and suffering in the world? Is that because we choose to?
Yeah, I don't know.
Do wrong?
I don't know. You know, I could dissect that and I could tell you my opinions, but it would be my opinions and it would be nothing that came from the near-death experience. So,
didn't you say we are all interconnected?
Connected. We're one.
We are one.
Yes.
That reminds me of a classic quote, no man is an island entire of itself. Mm-hmm. Any man's death diminishes me, for I am involved in mankind, and therefore never ask to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee.
Like, perfect. Perfect. That would be actually literal. You could take that literally. Just because your vantage point is from here with your physical eyes, you assume that this is who you are and this is what you are. We are one. It has nothing to do with what your eyes are seeing. I'm you, you're me. We are one. We are one.
I am curious. I understand that we have spirits that are light, that are looking out for our good. Mm-hmm. I also understand that there are spirits of darkness that may be trying to destroy us. Mm-hmm. In your life review, did you see any of those spirits and who might have been helping you versus tormenting you?
I've seen all different kinds of spirits now. Like that door didn't close for me. So if I go stay someplace that's haunted, they kind of poke at me a little bit. You know, I've kind of seen it all. But I've seen angels at different times as well. 2 years before I had my third baby, which was a complete surprise, 7 years later. And I was out digging in the yard, and there was a little boy that appeared. He was about 7, 8 years old, little striped shirt, little bowl cut, looked just like my older two kids, except for his hair was kind of red-brown. Scared the daylights out of me for about 2 seconds. And I knew I was seeing a spirit, and he was in color, but I knew it was a spirit. When I was expecting him, just getting ready to give birth, my mother-in-law also saw him. But the thing about him is just like really melancholy. And she said that he was standing by the bed, and that he didn't say a word. And then later, my husband saw him sitting on the couch, this in his underwear, like he was watching TV. And this was the week I had him. And then after he was born, I was laying in bed with him. And I was surrounded by angels that were just like hovering above us. He's an amazing kid, a brilliant child. He's 17 now. But then there were times too. There's times too when I've seen dark spirits. I've seen all of it. But what I will tell you, I'm actually writing another book right now, and it's called The Dandelion Principle. And I've been visiting Dan Lafferty in prison for about a year, and I'm writing with his daughter. And if you don't know who Dan Lafferty is, he and his brother killed their sister-in-law and her baby back in 1984, believing they heard God's voice. You know, I got all kinds of warnings. Don't go. Don't do it. He's dangerous. You know, he's got this, you know, power, this evilness. And what's shown up is that when I bring non-judgment, it just nullifies. It nullifies it. And what's showing up for him is he's actually beginning to question whether or not God told him to do that. And he's been in prison for almost 30 years now, just diagnosed schizophrenic, lost cause. He will always believe that. And just out of me visiting him, like three Fridays for an hour and a half, has elevated who he is. Because I'm just clear it's amputation when we cut somebody off and just pretend they don't belong to us. You know, I'm all about elevating who we are as a human race. So, it's fear no evil. Okay, fear no evil.
You said that you were taken in Gethsemane into Christ's body. Are you? That's probably a pretty sacred experience. Are you able to elaborate at all? Were you able to gain a greater understanding of what he did for us? Are you able to?
Yep. It's no longer conceptual for me. It's not like, oh, this suffering, and then there was blood from every pore. It's not like that. It's like he lived my life. He was there through every single minute, every little thing that happened. It's like he was me, and that was happening to him. Like my life was his life was mine, and he did that for everyone. Everyone, everyone.
I have read your book. It's excellent. Looking forward to the second one.
Thanks.
One area that still really confuses me, when you returned, were you resubjected to the depressions and the ominous futility of your life, or were there other burdens placed before you now that you had new light?
Well, it was two things that happened. The first is you can't have that kind of an experience with and come back and be the same person. It's just impossible. So I had elevated comprehension of some things. Like I was forever more clear that I was not alone in anything. I just never went there again. It's not something you'd do twice. And it's not like this magic bullet either where all of a sudden life is easy. You know, one of the things I was told is it's supposed to be hard. You know, you can't skip over parts. We've all done this. So I still had to deal with what I had to deal with. A nice little analogy might be the difference between Christ doing what he did for us without an angel and then with an angel. Kind of like that. Because so much is complete for me, though. Just like not the same human being.
In my experience, I've done a lot of clinical work, and so I've kind of learned on both a psychological and on a spiritual level that people will not pass from this realm unless they have agreed to or chosen to, either prior to this life or sometime during this life. And it's not always something that they're real conscious to. But I mean, when in private therapy sessions, a lot of times patients would confess that to me, but they hadn't told their closest loved one, their spouse or their family, because they didn't want to hurt them, and that they had agreed that they were ready to leave this life, or they had felt that they were ready to go. So I wanted to ask you if you had, in your experience prior to your death experience, if you had both agreed at some point to have a death experience and or just kind of following along with the free agency, free will, and accountability thing, if while you were on the other side, you were, I would assume, so I'm asking if you were given that opportunity to both come back or to stay.
Well, it wasn't asked directly, do you want to come back or stay? But there was not. The last thing was, okay, well, look at your kids. Look what's going to happen to your children if you stay here. And that was the thing that would do it for me. Because, I mean, that was why I took my life in the first place. And I would say that we don't do anything unless it's by agreement, that there's always an agreement in place.
Thanks. That answers my question. And it helps me to understand a little bit more about how you, just a follow-up question really quick. I was really inspired by what you had said about your Gethsemane experience and particularly about how Christ had experienced Gethsemane. I have a belief that all of us will probably need to experience our own Gethsemane because I do understand the concept of why we are experience hardships and trials, both some that are we are called to and we agree to and some that we bring that are self-imposed. To refine us and purify us as, and sanctify us as people. In your experience, do you feel that all of us will be need to experience a Gethsemane?
All I can speak to is what happened to me. That's all I can really tell you about is this was the near-death experience I had, and it's not going to be the same one I have the next time. And everybody gets one. There's some elements that are kind of across the board that some near-death experiencers experience these, some experience these, and, you know, there's some commonalities, but different people will have different near-death experiences. And so I can't really speak to that necessarily. All I can tell you is what I experienced.
I had a question about free will, and you talk about agreements that we make and that we're going to do things based on those agreements. So where does the free will come in? Does it come in when we make those agreements?
Yeah, see, that's kind of a linear question, and it's not a linear answer.
I've had a lot of experiences where people come back and their opinions of organized religion changes. So mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could comment on that and your experience.
Yep. I'm a Hindu, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Christian, I'm a Jew, to quote Gandhi. You know, what I like to say is, if it's working, get on that horse and ride it. I would never, ever tell somebody, don't do this, don't do that, as far as what is working with regard to religion. I've got my own views, and I do that. You know, it disempowers people to undermine or underestimate the power of their beliefs. Of their belief system. If it empowers you, great. If your religion has killed people, maybe not. Yes.
Did you say that at the time you knew you were dead, you felt the blackness, the darkness at your lower extremities?
Well, it was a mist, actually, is the way I'd describe it, but not like water. Actually, kind of like water. But it was a material that I knew was for creative purposes. Light is also a creative material. Darkness is a creative material. They can never inhabit the same space, ever. They do never occupy the same space. It may look like it, but it's just because it's going like this. And it is the energy that is behind all things. Any dark acts, you all have the power to feel this. You know. I know when I'm in the room with somebody who is filled with darkness, I can see it. You know, it's present.
What position were you in when you sensed that? Did you feel standing. Like they're standing up?
Okay. I was standing the entire time, except when I was in the Garden of Gethsemane, and then I wasn't.
Angie, you said you had a blog. What is your blog?
Yeah, go to angiefenimore.com.
Angie?
Angiefenimore.com. Yes. And you can email me at angie@angiefenimore.com, and then I also have a number there, a phone number. You can call me there. You can text me.
I have trouble with forgiving and... I worked at the prison 17 years, and I interacted with Lafferty.
Mm-hmm. Which one, Ron or Dan
both.
Or both?
Okay, I worked. Cool. I was a lieutenant.
Awesome.
There
yeah.
Years ago. Okay, you've spoken about angels and demons have been around you. You've seen them and stuff.
Yes.
Are they with you when you visit him? See, I...
They cannot be in my presence.
There was nobody in there when I
nothing but
interacted with him.
Yeah, nothing but light can be in my presence because that's what I'm bringing.
So you don't see his evil?
I bring non-judgment. I bring peace. I bring love. I bring forgiveness.
So you've got the good angels with you not to have that judgment.
I have actually two very powerful angels that are with me that used to be what I'd call my imaginary friends when I was a kid, Iga and Eber, is what I called them. Uh-huh. And now now I'm just present to them. Now I know. But see, I'm called to this. It's one of the things I came back to do, is to teach forgiveness, bring forgiveness.
So kind of like I was there not to do that.
No, not
no,
like
no.
That.
I mean, no. I'm not saying that
not like
bad.
That.
No, I'm just saying. But I was called, kind of in the other direction to maybe see him, because it was at the very beginning. In 84.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you, the very first experience I had with him was, I was taking psychology classes at BYU, and I was running a halfway house for the mental hospital, Alpine House in Provo, where they'd just come dump him, and then we, did the revolving door, we'd get them and they'd go back. And I was also working at Los Hermanos, which is kitty corner from the, it used to be kitty corner from the courthouse. And I was walking to work and I'm walking through that green belt over by the tabernacle. I can feel this immense darkness emanating from across the street. And I turn and it's Ron and Dan, and they're being escorted by an entourage of officers. They're shackled to each other in the orange jumpsuits. I was actually paralyzed, like I could not move. And then Dan turned and looked directly at me. Whatever was inhabiting his body knew me intimately. And I had this experience of being just like completely violated. I couldn't even shake it for a long time. And then because of the background I'd had as a kid, it was clear there was way more to the story. And what about these poor kids that were... And so this is 3 decades ago, by the way. So I went to work really shaken, and we all talked about it at work, and nobody could figure out how in the world this nice family could careen into such darkness. And then I went into victim advocacy, changed the laws governing violent sexual offenders in the state of Washington. And really, this was the thing. This was the catalyst for me. It just opened up this floodgate of memories that I had suppressed. And that was the thing that actually was the pinnacle when I took my life. This was something I dealt with, because I dealt with a lot of these kinds of offenders that did unspeakable things. And that darkness, it's the same, you know, with each one of them, it's the same. What do you do with that? What do you do with these victims? What do you do with these families? Like, how do you make sense of this? And, you know, for me, it was like, what merciful God? Really? I'm going to save the world since you're not. After having the near-death experience, like, what I got is that we want to reverse the order of things. We're stingy with our forgiveness. We're stingy like it's ours. Like, I'm going to reserve this for when you deserve it. That actually has energy flow such that we're consumers and has us be separate and small. If we will just bring forgiveness for no stinking reason, no reason at all, I forgive you, it reverses the flow of energy such that things alter on this planet, so there is no more sex crime, there is no more hunger. It won't be tolerated anymore. The minute we're all doing that, the earth changes like that. So, this was an experiment that his daughter and I took on. I've got a text from a friend of mine that says, guess who I'm with? Rebecca Lafferty. And I just texted right back, I need to meet with her. Like, I just knew I needed to meet with her. This is 4 years ago. And then I read the rest of the text, and it says, she says she needs to meet with you. So I'm sitting across from her, and we just look at each other, and it's not like, how do I know you? It's how many millions of years have I known you? She says, you're going to give me healing around my father. I said, then we're going to write your story. And it's just been this amazing journey, and that's what we've done, is we've just forgiven. Forgive, forgive. I bring daughter, forgive, for all daughters. And it elevates who that man is. There's no darkness there. It's like, it's disappearing.
I'll work on it some more.
Here's the thing, you guys, you make it hard. Just when you notice you're not, stop it. Stop doing that.
But there were so many to notice in my...
Yeah, but see, you're withholding it because you feel justified. You have, like, justification. Give that up, because I promise you, it's not ours. It is not ours.
Hi, I have a cute little story to share with everybody. If you have not gone to your local library and gotten a film that was made a few years ago, and they had it on Oprah, it's called The Secret, and it's all about kind of this exact same thing about how each and every human being is connected and we all have power. And if you will just focus on something that you want or that you need and just unceasingly believe in it, that it will happen.
I'd like to add something to that, though, because I don't think that's entirely accurate. It really requires action. You live in a physical world. It requires physical action in order to impact a physical world. So you can't just, like, wish all children not hungry. You got to get off your patoosks right now. Yes.
What a beautiful spirit you have, Angie. Thank you for sharing your story. I heard you earlier this week interviewed on the radio.
Oh, was I on K-Talk or was it all?
It was. And you were asked if you were shown anything in the future.
Bill.
And you mentioned something about the year 2015.
Okay, I'm not going there, y'all.
Could you tell us just briefly what that's about, please?
No, I won't. He's so funny. He got me in so much trouble. He asked me also, so are you married? I'm like, no. He's like, is there anybody special? And I've got so many of the guys I'm dating mad at me right now. Because they want to know, was that you? Because I said, there's somebody special, but I don't know. We'll see. Here's the thing. It's all interactive. It's like if you threw one of those 1,000 puzzle piece thingies up in the air, and it's all just like this, okay, like a puzzle, 1,000 pieces, 5,000 pieces. It's like that. And it does come down in perfect order, but nobody knows. It's all interactive, and it's completely and entirely up to us. Now, Mills is kind of a bomb shelter kind of guy. I'm not doing any of that, I will tell you. I'm not buying silver yet, but it's going to end for everybody. Everybody gets a point where they're at the end of their life. And I tell you what, like, I would never do anything like that, but I can't wait. Like, I'm so excited to go back and be with them. But at the same time, I'm just going to live my life completely, fully, and give all there is to give. Do all that I can do. Make every minute of difference I can make while I'm on this planet. And that's what I'd live from. That's my advice. Live from that and quit worrying about the timestamp. Because that's not even real.
My question is about forgiveness. You
yes.
mentioned you forgave your father.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure, and you had to forgive your mother also. Mm-hmm. And do you feel like in therapy you had to relive the pain to put it behind you?
No, I don't think that's necessary at all. All transformation happens on a dime, all of it. We take a long time suffering and making it a big deal and all about us. And then there's a moment when you give it up and you really get it's not about you. And when you do that, it's just present. Forgiveness is just present. If any of you were wondering, here's the key. Quit being located over here where you are. You get into their experience, what it has been like for them. And forgiveness is just like the natural expression.
So it was a conscious decision you made at some point to forgive and to let go.
I couldn't do anything but.
No more victim.
I just couldn't. Once I got my parents' world and what they dealt with, it was just like, if I got my mother's DNA, okay, if I had every experience my mother had, and then I interpreted it the way she had, if I got my mother's parents, I would have done the same thing. Not I might have, I would have. If I got all of it, then I would have. Like, there's nothing to do. There's nothing to do but forgive.
Would you mention the name of your first book?
Beyond the Darkness. And if you get it, there's a typo on page 101. Okay? It says, Heavenly Father had a great white beard. He didn't. It was a neat white beard. And I had this argument with my editor. It was so funny. She wanted to say great white. And then she calls me as soon as I got that. She's like, I want you to know that was a typo. I didn't do that on purpose.
Thank you for your story. It was great and inspiring. And clearly you have a great purpose on Earth. But when you were in purgatory, when you were talking about that, you had that moment of, you saw your life and you went through that review, but you felt nothing. You're like, okay, that's that. Kind of like not a lot of emotion.
Yeah, I was pretty dead.
Okay.
I was dead.
From, yes, but.
But I mean dead. I don't mean like physical body dead. I mean there's.
Did you feel like you were measured in any way for any of your life, for any of the experiences?
Nope. I was told you've been a tool for evil.
Oh,
but okay. You see, it wasn't about being judged, you've been a tool for evil. It was about, that's really not who you are.
Did you feel like after this experience or through this experience, did you come to a conclusion that we are living in some kind of game, in a way?
A game. What do you say a little more about that?
Well, it's just sometimes I think we're living in some type of a game, like your purgatory experience. You just experience your life, and that was that.
Yeah, I can't speak to that, really. I'd have to think about that.
Okay. I'd love to hear your answer.
Yeah, that's not how I experienced it, but...
Or some people say school.
I wouldn't even say that.
Just an experience, then.
It's just an opportunity. It's an opportunity. That's the way I saw it.
An opportunity to come here and to live and to... Mm-hmm.
There came a point where I quit asking the question, why am I here? And why does it look like this? And I asked a more empowering question of myself, which is, what's my life for? And the minute I did that, I quit being hung up on the details. It's really pointless stuff. It's kind of like this, okay? I started working with a trainer 10 days ago, okay? He tells me I'm going to look like a Victoria's Secret model in 23 minus 3 days, weeks from now, because it was a 24-week program. And I just said, you know what? I'm going to do every single thing you tell me to do. I'm going to eat every single thing you tell me to eat, and I'm not going to eat what you tell me I shouldn't eat. And I have honored my word. I have not violated one time. I was a size 14 10 days ago, and I'm a size 10 tonight. Okay? Yeah. Pretty cool, huh?
That's great.
So the point, though, is this. my life is for something. I don't have to know what my trainer knows. I hired a trainer. He did all that. I just got to put in my mouth what he says. Put that in your mouth. Don't put that in your mouth. That's really it. Lift this much weight. Don't cheat. Knock it down 5. Okay, I can do that. It's like that. It's like when we get caught up in the details, you lose focus. It doesn't really matter so much. The details don't matter so much. Who you are in the matters is what really makes the biggest difference.
Okay, thank you.
You commented about the music that you were listening to before.
Yep.
Would you want to comment about music in general, or have you changed what you listen to?
Oh, yes. I actually go to Kirtans all the time now. A friend of mine, his name is Kopo. Some of you might know Kopo. Clint Crawford does a lot of the Kirtans. I love that stuff. See if I can articulate this. Everything has a voice. Every molecule has a voice. You are comprised of about 70% water, right? It is motion that has life continue. So rivers, body of water, if there's no inlet and no outlet, that body of water dies. You, when your blood stops flowing, your body dies. Air stops coming in and out, your body dies. Currency, money, when it stops moving is when we have problems. There's a reason we call it currency. Life is like this. It's about the motion of things. And so our access to having abundancy as human beings is to give so that you create space for more to arise. Everything has a physical creation, a spiritual creation, and an energetic creation. So all the molecules around you are actually impacted by the sound vibration. So that's why I love to hang out with Kopo, is that he can hear this too. He has this gift as well, where he can hear on a cellular level. And there are certain tones, when you put them together, empowers cells, empowers molecules, empowers the energy on the planet. It raises the vibration for all of us. And then there are certain tones, when you put them together, that resonate darkness and create darkness. And darkness begets darkness, light begets light. And then when you pair words with those tones, that's when you've really created something. There's a lot of music I won't listen to anymore. What actually had me write the near-death experience in the first place was that Kurt Cobain killed himself. And I knew there were going to be kids that killed themselves because he did. Yeah, there's stuff I just, you know, whatever. But I also not impacted anymore either, because like I have this bring non-judgment thing pretty down.
I don't know exactly how to word this either. I appreciate everything that you've given us tonight. If you yourself or just people in general have been there with those kinds of thoughts about ending their life, I'm thinking when you got on the other side, whatever point, whether it was the purgatory or where, what kind of suffering or what happened or what were you told that was the wrong thing to do?
The moment was when I saw my children's lives. It was no longer about me anymore. That was the moment.
So aside, though, from that vision, personal suffering?
Suffering is self-imposed. It's what you make it mean, and it doesn't mean that at all. It means that my mother left, that she joined this cult, and they weren't feeding Petey, and I fed Petey, so they didn't feed me. I made that mean my mother doesn't love me. Okay, so I suffered a lot of years believing my mother doesn't love me. That was not the case at all. My mother was dealing with some stuff. And once I got that, she's holding me, and I got my mother loves me. It was put to bed for me. When I got like, oh, wow, my mom also lived a life.
And I get that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important principle for all of us to kind of be aware of. I just wondered if suicide itself...
Well, it's not a good idea. Don't do that, okay?
And what would you say to somebody that
me.
Is...
Get help, call your mother, call your best friend, call 911.
Right, yeah.
Do something besides that. Don't do that.
There's something
don't
about
do that.
That. Okay.
Yeah.
Or they could call Angie. I recall.
Yes, please do.
Thank you very much for your questions, and we thank Angie for coming and sharing with us.
Thanks.